Of the 102 recorded episodes of Hancock's Half Hour, 20 are missing from the archives. But to coincide with the show's 60th anniversary, five of these episodes have been remade for Radio 4, starring Kevin McNally as the lad himself. So for the first time since 1954, here's the Hancock Festival.
This is the BBC Light Programme. We present Tony Hancock with Moira Lister, Bill Kerr and Sidney James in...
Hancock's Half Hour.
As listeners to the Light programme will know, the BBC is currently presenting a festival of the works of that great storyteller W. Somerset Maugham, which has created tremendous interest among listeners throughout the country. It has even, apparently, made an impression on Tony Hancock. Since he heard the first of these programmes, Tony has become a different man.
Just exactly what is going on, Bill?
Yeah, don't ask me, Maura. All I know is I got a phone call from Tony asking me to come round straight away.
I wonder what it's all about.
Oh, I wish I knew. I haven't seen him. He hasn't left his room for days.
Oh, I hope he hasn't got wedged in again.
No. He's got his typewriter up there. He's been typing day and night, non-stop.
Well, that explains it. It's getting near Christmas. Time for his begging letters to go out.
Nah, there's more to it than that. He's got some idea running through his head.
Yes. Mind you, it's got plenty of space to move around in.
Well, he was acting perfectly normally right up until last Sunday afternoon.
And what happened?
Well, nothing, really. We were just sitting quietly listening to the radio. One of those Somerset Maugham plays they're broadcasting. And it seemed to have some effect on him. When it was all over, he just sat there, staring into space. Strange light in his eyes. His mouth wide open.
Remember the last time he looked like that? He was lying flat on his back underneath a beer barrel with the tap turned on.
Yeah, but this was different. Suddenly he jumped up, grabbed his typewriter, went up to his room. Haven't seen him since.
I just don't understand it. What can he be doing?
Greetings.
Oh, morning, Tup.
Hello, Tony.
Be seated. Pray forgive this untimely hour, but I have summoned you here today so that you may be the first to hear the momentous news that is destined to surprise all my friends.
You're not starting work.
You're quite right, I'm not starting work.
Tony, before we go any further, why have you locked yourself in your room all week?
I'm coming to that. For the past 7.5 days, I have been giving vent to all the creative histrionic genius that for many years throughout my young life has been burning inside my tortured soul like the very clappers. In short, I have been writing. I am now an author, a literateur. I have given birth to a book that will shake the literary world.
Won't pass unnoticed in the medical world.
Yes, that's it. Go on, laugh at me. I don't care. They laughed at Puccini. They laughed at Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, Chopin, and all them other great painters. But the proof rests in the great work I have produced. Behold the fruits of my artistic labours. Me manuscript.
Oh, let's see. 97 short stories from the pen of A. Somerset Hancock.
Somerset? Oh, no, that's going a bit too far.
All right, then, seeing as I come from Birmingham, we'll change it to A. Staffordshire Hancock.
Tell me, Staff, just what inspired you to do this?
Many things. The burning desire to create a great work of art. The long-felt ambition to accomplish something that will be handed down to posterity. The need to express my innermost soul and impart a profound message for the benefit of mankind. And lastly, I've just found out how much lob Somerset Maugham cops each year.
So
I am having a go.
Don't be ridiculous. Somerset Maugham's a master of the English language.
Listen, I can write English as good as what he can.
Oh, even better.
Well, certainly no worse. Don't you worry, mate. I'll have the lot you watch. Nobel Prize, literary luncheons, and a dirty great villa on the French Riviera. Right in the middle of the old Cote d'Azur.
Just a minute, genius. Who is going to publish these stories?
Ah, no one. They're for broadcasting. I'm doing them on my next radio show. If the BBC can do a 5-week festival of Somerset Maugham stories, they can find somewhere to put mine.
I'm sure they will.
Well, exactly. First the Somerset Maugham Festival, and now the Staffordshire Hancock booze up. Three of me best short stories adapted for radio, which brings us to the question of casting. Now, I've been very fair about this. I don't want to be greedy. I mean, you know me. So I've divided the parts up equally. Each of us has the same amount to do. Here you are. One page for you, Kurt.
Ah, thanks.
Half a page for you, Moira.
Thank you.
Now, all we've got to... Hello, where's page 67 of my lot? Who's got my page 67?
Yeah, there it is, sticking out from behind page 94.
Oh, yes, so it is. Now, we'll need someone else, because three people's not enough to do three plays.
Come in.
Ah, just the boys I've been looking for.
Sydney.
Mr. James, what are you doing here? I've told you before not to come round here in daylight.
Now, that's a fine way to talk to your bookmaker. Here, I've got some news for you.
What?
You know that horse I told you to put 30 quid on? That cast iron dead cert can't lose, surefire odds-on favourite? The one you said wouldn't win?
Well?
It didn't. You owe me 30 nickel.
Look, I can't pay you now. You'll have to wait till me stories are published.
When will that be?
As soon as they've been broadcast. Once the publishers hear them, they'll be round me like flies on a rubbish heap.
I couldn't have put it better myself. So, you're going to do some broadcasting, eh? Tell you what I'll do. We'll scrub round the 30 nigger if you give me a part in the broadcast. I've always fancied myself as an actor.
You? An actor?
Of course, I was the star of the Dartmoor Follies of 1929. Ran for 15 years with the same cast. Ah, those were the days. All the fans waiting outside the prison gates with their fingerprint books.
Well, all right, then. We'll give it a try. Here's your part. Right, now we're all set. History is about to be made. A new genius is about to be launched into the literary sea.
Oh, I only hope it's 200 miles off the coast of Peru.
Ah, can't you just see it? The Staffordshire Hancock Festival of 1954.
Ladies and gentlemen, the BBC is proud to announce that they have obtained, at very little expense, the broadcasting rights to the complete works of Mr. Anthony Staffordshire Hancock, the unknown author of Worldwide Obscurity, whose works have been translated into no less than one language. English. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we now present a trio of three short stories entitled Triplets. And first we have... The Moon and Fourpence Halfpenny.
Even in those days, income tax.
It was in Tahiti where I first met Paul Goggin. He was a great painter who had turned his back on civilization and gone to the South Seas where he could paint in peace. We met quite by accident. A boat had just docked and the tourists were amusing themselves, throwing small coins into the water and watching the native boys dive in to retrieve them.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Your first visit?
Yes.
I think you'll like it.
I hope so.
It grows on one.
Really?
You find it gets a hold of you.
Does it?
After a time, you never want to leave.
No.
I've lived here for some years.
How I envy you.
Life takes on a new meaning here.
Yes.
You'll find it different from London.
I dare say.
The sun, the waving palms, the blue sea. It's a paradise.
Isn't it?
Oh, look. The tourists have stopped throwing coins in the water.
Yes, so they have.
Oh, well... We might as well swim ashore and dry ourselves.
That was my first meeting with Paul Goggin. He'd lived on the island for 40 years, living on coconuts. He'd eaten so many coconuts, every time he stuck his head out of a window, someone threw a ball at him. He was desperately poor. Many a long hour I spent with him in his rude cabin, looking at his rude paintings. He was very proud of his work.
Look, what do you think of this one? I only painted it last week. I call it still life.
Oh, yes. Two apple cores, a banana skin, and a pile of orange peel.
One gets hungry.
You haven't much money, have you, Paul?
Oh, I manage. The natives are very kind to me. They bring me food. Have another piece of arm.
Paul, why don't you give all this up? Go back to London, make a fresh start.
They won't let me sell me pictures in London.
Why not?
The pavements belong to the council. Another glass of milk?
Yes, please.
Right, I'll nip out and give the coconut tree a kick. Oh, it's no good. I'm a failure. Nobody wants me paintings. The spark is gone. I'm no use to anybody. Nothing to offer. The world would be better off without me. I'll end it all. I'll throw myself in the sea. That's it. The sea. The sea. Goodbye. The tide's out.
Paul, pull yourself together. Have you nothing to live for?
Only Fenalia. She's a native girl. Does me mending, me washing, poses for me. You should meet Fenalia. I think you'll like her. I'll call her. Fenalia! Fenalia! Oi, Fenny!
You called me, Paul?
I gasped in amazement.
She was the most beautiful creature I'd ever seen. Her dusky skin contrasted sharply with her flashing white teeth. She was dressed in typical South Sea fashion, a garland of flowers round her neck and a simple Hawaiian skirt, on which was pinned a notice, "Keep off the grass." Under her arm, she was carrying a bundle of tattered old rags.
Paul, I've brought your laundry back. Oh, and I've done all the mending. I darned that great big hole in the top of your sock.
Well done. I can't get it on now.
Will you be wanting me to pose for you today?
Yes, I must try and get that portrait finished. Now, the pose. The pose. Ah, yes. Stand in the hallway and...
I'll come with you.
Oh, no, we are not going to pose in the hall together.
Quick, Fenelia, the portrait. Well, the muse is with me. Sit down, that's it. Now put the shield by your side. Perfect. Now hold the spear like this. That's it. Don't move. Where's me brush? Bit of green. Touch of white here. Bit more green. Little more white. Another touch of green. Sign it. There. Finished.
Why, that's perfect. What are you going to call it?
A pound note. Try it in front of the fire and nip out and get some grub.
Anybody in?
Paul, it's the governor. Lord James of Whitechapel.
What can he want with me? The governor hasn't been here for weeks. Ask him in.
Will you step this way, your lordship?
Here, you, the one with the corduroy sarong. Are you the geezer what paints?
Paul Goggin, at your service.
Well, listen, Gog, I've heard a lot about you, see. They say you're quite a dab hand with the old brush.
I have me moments. Have a butcher's at some of me canvases. Here's what I done that might interest you. Self-portrait.
Who of?
Who of? Blimey, some mothers don't half get lumbered. Who of? I'm not quite sure. Let's have a look. Oh, yes, of course, it's me.
It looks like Gregory Peck.
I can dream.
Yeah, I like that one hanging on the wall over there. That Tahiti street scene. The palm trees, the people, the ships in the harbour. Looks almost lifelike.
It should do, that's the window.
Look, I'll tell you what I want. I've got a commission for you. I want you to paint for me. Government House looks a bit bare. It could do with a bit of brightening up.
Paul, this is your big chance. Government House. All the influential people of the island will see your work. You will be famous.
Yes, I always knew I could do it. Yes, you'll see. I'll be as good a painter as that little bloke, Jose Ferrer. Quick, me paints, me brushes, to work.
From that day, Paul was a changed man. He painted furiously day and night, working like a man possessed. I shall never forget that fat little figure standing there in his brown smock and bare legs. He looked like a toffee apple with two sticks.
On and on he worked, the deft, bold strokes of his brush pouring out all the creative genius that had burned within him for years. Painting, all the time painting. By this time he was working so quickly we couldn't supply him with paint fast enough.
That tube of green paint you bought me this morning, it's no good. I can't paint with it. What's it called?
Let's see. Chlorophyll toothpaste.
It was fantastic to watch him. I've never seen a man paint with such speed and precision. And then finally, 3 months later...
Oi, Goggin, haven't you finished painting yet?
Don't stop me. I must work fast before the light fades. I must catch all the delicate tones, the pastel shades, the vermilions, the ultramarines, all blended together in one glorious harmony of colour. Just a few more strokes. There you are. The master has finished.
Paul, it's beautiful. Your greatest work yet.
The touch of a genius.
What do you think, Lord James?
Marvellous, marvellous. Best painting I've seen for years. Just one thing.
What?
How much do you charge to put the wallpaper up as well?
On behalf of the actors and myself, I thank you. There will now be a short interlude before our next offering to enable us to shift the furniture around and make a quick change of costumes. Buns and lemonade can be had from the vicar at the trestle table at the back of the hall. Interval over. Music, please.
Continuing the Staffordshire Hancock Festival of 1954, we now present story number two, The Casino. I knew the Honourable Reggie Faversham only by name until that fateful winter in Monte Carlo in 1947. He'd been left a great deal of money by his father, the Earl, who had died in rather mysterious circumstances the year before. Reggie came into a great deal of money and a great deal of suspicion. 2 days later, Reggie drove up to the funeral in his unusually immaculate new sports car with a battered mudguard.
I met him at Monte Carlo, where his extravagant gambling soon became the talk of the casino. On the night in question, I accompanied him to the gaming room. As we entered...
Ah, good evening, monsieur.
Good evening.
Bonjour. You are here to visit the gambling tables again, monsieur?
Of course I am.
Allow me to take your hat.
Thank you.
Your cloak,
murky.
Your gloves, and your cane. Thank you, monsieur.
What a nice man. Who is he?
No one knows. But he's rapidly becoming the best-dressed man in Monte Carlo.
Ah, well, says Dizzy Bond. Come to the gambling tables. I have a new system to try out.
Oh, what is it?
First I back numero un, then deux, then trois, then quatre, then cinq, and then six.
Why?
I'll have to. I won't have any lob left after all that lot. Ah, here's the roulette room.
Mesdames et messieurs, faites vos jeux, s'il vous plaît. Faites vos jeux.
Garcon, here's £40,000. Bring me some chips.
Certainly. Anything else?
Yes, two bits of rock salmon and a lump of skate.
Allô, chérie.
I turned round to look at the owner of the voice. To my relief, it was a woman. She was wearing an evening gown that started where most people's finished. She stood there with one hand resting on her hip. The cigarette in her holder smouldered not an inch from my face. This intrigued me. She was standing on the other side of the table. She spoke to Reggie.
Chérie, you must be an Englishman, no?
Yes, how can you tell?
Simple, I once saw you in the front row of the Folies Bergères.
Well?
If you were a Frenchman, you would have been up on the stage. Permit me to introduce myself. I am Michelle Duvassois, Comtesse Duvassois.
Her evening gown was cut so low, I could see at a glance she wasn't the barefoot Contessa.
I have been watching you these last few nights. I have noticed you... is my cigarette holder bothering you?
No, just lean it up against the wall. It'll be all right.
As I was saying, I have noticed that you have been losing very heavily at the table.
Oh, I don't know. Only about 20 or 30,000 pounds. That's me 25 quid travelling allowances.
You have more money?
Oh, yes. I've got another 4.5 million what my old man left me. Because he had a good job, you know. He was Bernard Docker's chauffeur. A few crafty scrapings off his gold-plated bumper, it soon mounts up. Then there's me... Oh, dear, dear, stone me. What was that?
Take no notice. It happens all the time in Monte Carlo. Some poor devil loses everything he possesses, and so, poof. No money, no worries, no disgrace.
No head.
Precisely.
Reggie, have you heard the news? Young Algie Blackworth is losing 10,000 at the roulette table. Could you lend him some?
No, he's got plenty.
Come, chérie, perhaps I can help you win some of your money back. There is a very rich American in the next room. He loves gambling with the cards. He doesn't mind how much he loses. I could arrange for you to play with him.
Oh, no, not me, dear. Never gamble with cards. It's too chancy. Lose too much money. You find someone else. I'm not touching the cards.
His eyesight's not very good.
Bag's first deal.
Wait here. I'll go and tell the American you're ready.
Oi, Max.
Hello.
I've got a mug outside loaded with lollies.
Oh, good girl, Daisy. Send them in.
Half a mo. Monsieur Faversham, would you care to step in here?
Certainly. Where's the cards?
Well, Mr. Faversham, this is indeed an honor.
Charmed. What's trumps?
My name is Hiram P. Gluckenheimer. I'm an oil.
So am I. 15th oil of Faversham Castle.
I understand you're looking for a game of cards.
That's right.
Good. How about a round of gin rummy to start?
Good idea. Waiter, 3 gin rummies, please. Don't put too much rum in mine.
I say, ready. Young Algie Blackworth's losing 20,000 at the roulette table. Do lend him some.
No, he's still got plenty.
Well, Faversham, what game are you gonna play?
Oh, I don't mind. I'm a hard gambling man. Snap, beat your neighbors out of doors, anything you like.
Poker. Minimum stake, $25,000. I'll deal.
Shuffle them first.
Rightio.
You've played this before, haven't you?
Now, what on earth makes you think that?
Oh, nothing. It's just that I haven't seen anybody shuffle with their feet before.
Have a look at your cards.
Do you mind if I stand behind you, monsieur?
No. You might bring me luck. Now, let's see what I've got. Ah, good. A full house.
Standing room only?
Hey?
Nothing. Just talking to myself.
I'll tell you what. Save time. I bet you $300,000 I've got a better hand than you.
All right, I've got a full house.
So have I.
I've got two aces and three kings.
Ah, bad luck. I've got three aces and two kings.
Oh, well, we can't always win, can we? My deal. One, two, three. There. Now, let's see what I've got this time. Ooh, wonderful. Three kings. Madam, will you please stop that whistling? You're putting the gentleman off.
This time I've got $500,000 that says I've got a better hand than you.
All right, there. Three kings.
Oh, bad luck. I've got three jacks.
Wait a minute. Kings is higher than jacks.
Not in America, son. Everybody's equal.
Ah, democracy. What a wonderful thing.
You called, you lose.
But you called.
I've got a knife here that says you called.
Oh, yes, so I did. You want to hold on to that knife? It's got a wonderful memory.
I say, Reggie, young Algie Blackworth's lost £70,000 on the roulette table. You really must lend him some money.
Oh, all right. Where is he?
He's just left.
My deal, I believe, Mr. Faversham.
On they played through the night. Reggie lost a fortune with every hand. By 4 o'clock in the morning, the American had so much money piled in front of him, he had to make two holes to put his hands through. But still Reggie gambled, until in the cold light of dawn he stood there with not a penny left.
I'm waiting, Mr. Faversham. I'm betting you $1 million on this hand.
All right, I'll cover it. I'll wager Faversham Castle, me estate and the family jewels, all that I have left in the world.
Okay, what do you got in your hand?
Too good for you. Look, four aces. I've done it. I've won.
Just a minute. You haven't won. I've got three twos.
All right, go on. Surprise me. How does three twos beat four aces?
What's four ones?
Four.
What's three twos?
Six.
Six is better than four. You've lost.
Yes, but look, I don't... How can... He's right, you know, yes. Six is more than four. Well done. Oh, what am I going to do now? I'm ruined. My money gone. The family estate gone. Everything. I'm finished.
Remember what I said, monsieur? It happens all the time at Monte Carlo. There is only one way out.
You're right. It's the only way. I'll do it.
You may borrow my gun, sir.
Thank you. Goodbye, Mr. Gluckenheimer.
Goodbye, sir.
Oh, it is a great pity. He was rather nice.
Yeah, he wasn't bad, was he?
How could anyone... And so we come to the last story in the Staffordshire Hancock Festival, a tale set in a lonely British Army garrison on the northwest frontier. A tale of British courage, guts and endurance. Ladies and gentlemen, we present The Outpost. I first met Lieutenant Carruthers in Bombay. He was haggling with an old Indian over the price of some cigarettes Carruthers had just sold him. The Indian had offered him two annas, but Carruthers didn't fancy either of them and walked on. I didn't meet him again until we were both posted to the same regiment during the Afghan uprising of 97. The garrison was under the command of that seasoned Afghan fighter, Captain Sid Levy.
The position's serious, men. The Afghans are massing for all-out attack. If we advance to meet them, we shall be massacred. If we stay here, we shall be massacred. And if we retreat, we shall be massacred. Now, when I come back from leave, what I want you to do...
Now, I say, sir, steady on, sir. We're not staying here to fight the Afghans by ourselves. I want to go home, too.
Just as I thought. You're a coward.
Only when there's danger, sir.
What about you, Carruthers? You look like a brave man.
Quick, hand me a beard.
Carruthers and I weren't frightened for ourselves. You see, there was a woman in the fort, the colonel's daughter. Cynthia, the fairest flower of English womanhood, though at the time she was rapidly going to seed.
Cynthia, don't you see? It's madness for you to stop here. If the Afghans catch you, they'll show no respect for your honour.
Oh, good. I was counting on that.
Cynthia!
Well, none of you lot take any notice of me. That's the only reason I came out here. I thought someone might ask me to get married.
Cynthia, aren't you forgetting? We're British. British bred.
Well, for heaven's sake, let's breed.
The Afghans are attacking. Action stations, man the guns.
The Afghan tribesmen poured down from the surrounding hills. Hordes of yelling, screaming waziris urged on by their swarthy leader. In his bushy black beard and flowing white robes, he looked like Philip Harbin standing up in bed. Undaunted, the dwindling British force fought back against overwhelming odds.
Here they come again, sir. 50,000 of the swine and only four of us left. There's only one thing we can do.
What's that?
Charge!
Mind up, blood luck, sir. Mind up. Oh, I mean, sorry. That's the wrong program. I can't understand it. It looked like the Home Service. Oh, well, goodbye.
On we fought. No hardship too great. The medical supplies were exhausted and Cynthia was tearing pieces off her clothing to bind our wounds. To make it more interesting, Carruthers and I were shooting each other in the arms and legs. And still they came on.
Keep fighting, men. Remember, one Englishman is worth 20 Afghans. And so...
Yes?
I'm going to take one of you outside and swap you.
Something's got to be done. There's only four of us left. Captain Levy, Cynthia, Carruthers and myself. Can you handle a gun, Cynthia?
No, yes. Won't be the first time I've cradled a warm barrel in my arms.
So it was you and Carruthers behind the cookhouse last night.
Well, what of it? I love him, do you hear? Love him. He's the bravest and most conscientious one amongst you. Why, last night at the height of the attack, it was he alone, who stayed in the cellars all night, eating all the food and drinking all the wine, just so it wouldn't fall into the enemy's hands.
That's what I call guts.
Where is Carruthers now?
There he is, leaning over the battlements, chatting to that Afghan tribesman.
Of course, this isn't my first ambush, you know. I've been in quite a few. I was in that little lot at Pondicherry last year. You remember that one? Yes, I recognise you. Yes, you had a shorter beard then, I fancy. So anyway, I was captured and taken back to your hideout just in time for the tortures. Well, anyway, your chief comes over to me and says, "Here, I want to know the route of the relief column. Speak up, dog." Well, that was like a red rag to a bull to me. I mean, you know what I'm like. I'm only a little man, hard to rouse. Takes a lot to upset me, and that did. I was in there. I said, "You can't talk to me like that. I'm a British soldier. Listen to the old cheek." Well, that shook him. His curly-toed slippers nearly straightened out. The last thing he expected was for me to answer back. It impressed him. A smile of respect came over his face. He looked at me, just as I'm looking at you now, and fierce, uneducated savage though he was, do you know what he did? He cut me ears off.
Attacking again.
Well, this is it. They're making a final all-out assault.
We'll never hold them. This time they're heading straight for us.
Just a minute. Who's that man on horseback leading the attack?
Good heavens, it's a white man. He's firing at us.
That look of anger on his face, he's really determined to get us.
I don't wonder after this.
Why, who is it?
Somerset Maugham.
Run for your life!
You've been listening to Hancock's Half Hour, featuring Kevin McNally as the lad himself, with Kevin Eldon and Simon Greenall, Margaret Caban-Smith and David Carrick. Incidental music was composed by Wally Stott and recorded by the BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Levin Parikian. The script was written by Ray Galton and Alan Simpson. And the programme, which was recorded, was produced by Ed Morrish and Neil Pearson.